We've now looked at two types of burnt offerings. That is, two types of sacrifices that were placed onto the brazen altar and consumed by fire. Those were the olah and the mincha. And the olah involved the burning up of animals, the mincha, the burning up of plant life, of grain, typically. And I've emphasized that despite all the attempts to explain the purposes and the essences of these offerings, that the Bible, at this point of our study, makes it clear that it was the smoke from the sacrifices that was the primary element, and that the smoke was a pleasing aroma to God. Now, the question is, how are we Christians in modern times supposed to take this? I mean, are we to believe that Yahweh literally inhaled the smoke and he loved how it smelled, and this was the purpose of burning up his animals and plants? Well, in the minds of the Hebrews of that day, it certainly was a major reason for that ritual. And of course, this causes us some concern, doesn't it? Because immediately a mental picture comes to our minds of pagans sacrificing to their gods. And the pagan gods ate food, and they drank wine and beer. They had sex. They partied. They fought amongst themselves. They murdered one another, all right, and so on. So it would be a little easier for us to swallow if the several references to God smelling the fragrant aroma of the smoke from the burnt offerings in Leviticus chapters 1 and 2 were speaking of pagan rituals made to pagan gods, but they're not. They're speaking of Yahweh, the God of Israel, and these are his words. These sacrificial rituals of Leviticus have always created a problem for the church, and allegorizing it away has generally solved the problem. To begin to deal with this issue, here's what we must understand. All religions came essentially from one source. Therefore, there are many similarities between the myriad of religions practiced around the world, from Christianity to Judaism to Hinduism to Buddhism and all the rest. Without taking up too much time, let me flesh that out a little bit. Just a few years ago, the World's Academy of Linguists, these are academics who study languages, came to a conclusion they had been desperately trying to avoid for decades. All evidence now indisputably points towards the existence at one time of a single mother language. In other words, it is now all but irrefutable that all languages came from one. Long ago, there was but a single universal language, but over time, it somehow changed into many. And what is even more astonishing, according to these linguists, it seemed to happen overnight. Now, this isn't really very startling to any Christian child who's ever attended Sunday school, or Jewish child who's been taught the Torah. Because how and approximately when this transformation of one single language into many took place is told in the Bible. It happened at the Tower of Babel. And it was Yahweh who caused it to happen, both as a judgment for rebellion and in order that people would disperse and repopulate the world more completely. But from that same incident, something else of profound importance happened. The perverted worship that was occurring at the Tower of Babel, led by Nimrod, also changed and multiplied, and it followed all those dispersed people who now spoke those different languages. And the Bible calls this evil cauldron of the many pagan religions that resulted and that had their origin in Babel, the Babylon mystery religions. For all practical purposes, all false religions, which are by definition any who do not call solely on the name of the God of Israel. These are Babylon mystery religions, and they all have very similar, not identical, but very similar characteristics. Now, after the flood, the entire world's population consisted only of Noah's immediate family. And the family knew Yahweh well. They were dedicated to him because God had just delivered them from the flood. They knew who he was. They knew what he expected from mankind. They knew that he wanted sacrifices to be accomplished for a variety of reasons. They had a pretty good handle on God's program. All of Noah's family believed, and they practiced the one and only pure worship of the one and only true God. Eventually, though, in fairly short order, Noah's descendants, his own family, started to go their separate ways, and as they did, they began to add their own thoughts and their own desires that sprang from their sinful human nature to the proper worship of Yahweh. And by the time of Nimrod, mankind was once again thoroughly corrupt, and so was their worship. And due to mankind's common point of origin, each of these world's new religions took with them some common memory of the essential doctrines and characteristics of the true God who created them. But they modified and they twisted meanings and practices. And when you study them closely, the world's false religions are far more similar on the surface than they are unique. They all pretty much look alike. It's primarily cultural differences, societal traditions, names of the various gods that separate them. This is why we find so much commonality among the world's false religions. For instance, they all tend to have a flood story in their early history. Why? Well, there was a flood. Because all the world's cultures and peoples came from the family that survived the flood, Noah's. Most have a god hierarchy that consists of a chief supreme god, a male, his wife, and their son. Why? Because God's plan of having his son come into the world by means of a woman was known from the earliest days. Almost all pagan religions have their chief deity, a son, dying and then being reincarnated for that reason. Almost all pagan religions insist that there was a creation of all things whereby it was caused by a god or a goddess, because that indeed is how it was. And these same religions also insist there will be a definite end of the world caused by a god, because indeed that's how it will be. Many pagan religions have holy books. Some don't. Their religion speaks of an eternal God that is self-existent, a realm of spirit beings. Some of them are evil, some of them are good. Almost all pagan religions perform sacrifices of one sort or another to a god or a goddess. And usually it involves these sacrifices being burnt up by fire on an altar with smoke rising up to the gods who either live in or just above the clouds. The point I'm making is that many elements of the worship practices of the Israelite religion that we see being laid out in Leviticus by Yahweh were similar to pagan worship practices already in existence in that era, because almost all elements of pagan worship practices were simply highly corrupted versions of the original and true worship of the Father. What we see God doing with Moses, Israel, the law, is reestablishing his justice and his worship system. He's cleaning things up. He's reestablishing proper and true worship and doctrine, just as when he cleaned things up by destroying the entire world's population with a great flood and then starting over with a remnant. Let me attempt an admittedly inadequate illustration of this. I don't know if anyone here is into refinishing furniture. I don't particularly enjoy it, but I've done it. You can find the most horrible looking desk or chair or table with layers and layers of paint and dirt and goo that's been added to it for years. But with some work and some chemical stripper, it's possible to remove all that accumulated stuff that never belonged there, and underneath it all, you rediscover this beautiful, natural, original wood surface. That piece of furniture that looked like junk was restored from all of its ugliness to its original state and purpose. But you know something? It's still the same piece of furniture. That's what God was doing with Israel and the law. He was removing all the stuff that didn't belong there, bringing a remnant of humanity back into a condition that was closer to the way He made us. All the stuff that had no proper place in our life. All the stuff that prohibited a proper understanding, the true worship of God. This was stripped away. It was discarded. It was replaced with the truth. And oh, how the body of Christ needs that kind of revival in our time. We find in the Holy Scriptures that it is standard operating procedure for God to take people and cultures just as they are, and then use common elements of that culture that those people are completely familiar with as learning tools and illustrations of His grand plan. The Hebrews in the time of Moses pictured God in much the same way as everybody else on earth pictured their gods and goddesses, as some kind of a superhuman race. They weren't entirely correct, but that is how they thought of Him, and I have news for you. A lot of modern Christians essentially see God the same way, they just don't realize it. He was a God who, in the minds of the Hebrews, would speak, He'd walk, He'd jump with joy, He'd swing a sword, and yes, smell the fragrant aroma of incense and the smoke of all those burnt offerings. It takes a long time, in human terms, for humans to adopt real change. God has spent millennia bringing man from the birth of our existence in Adam and Eve to where we are today. And along the way, the Lord has used our familiar surroundings and practices, even our everyday human characteristics and foibles, to teach us the truth. And He has progressively shown us more of Him, more of His plans, one understanding building atop another as time marches on. His principles and His purposes are perfect, and they've never changed. But they have transformed. From the sacrifice of animals and grains to achieve peace with God, it is transformed to the sacrifice of Christ. With what righteousness consisted of, transformed from personal obedience and good behavior to being in union with the one in whom we place our faith. What I want you to take from this is this. In our study of Leviticus and the sacrifices and the stated and the implied reasons for those sacrifices, don't have worry or anxiety over taking the word of God literally. Even though at times it really bothers our modern minds, it seems to attack our sensibilities, especially in the older books of the Bible. Too many of our truly great Christian leaders and teachers have decided that the flock is just unable to handle some of the realities of Bible history, and so tell us that what we're reading isn't really what we're reading, that it means something else entirely. They're afraid we might lose faith if we see too much paganism, too much imperfection all tangled up in our Hebrew faith roots and in our Bible heroes. Well, I say that's nonsense. The Bible is simply the truth. And the truth is Abraham was at first a pagan. That the Hebrews were constantly struggling with idolatry and disobedience. It is truth that many of the worship practices of the Hebrews, as ordained by God and passed on to we believers, were similar in outward appearance to pagan worship practices that far predated the time of Moses. So in the matter of the smoke, which is what set me off on this tangent, yes, the Hebrews did envision God smelling that smoke and being pleased by it. Their real problem is that they just thought of the ritual sacrificial processes in a thoroughly physical, earthly sense, which in general was the same way they viewed God, instead of the spiritual, heavenly sense that would be slowly revealed to man as we became able to embrace it. And of course, it is that spiritual sense that Yeshua spends so much time explaining in the New Testament. So let's open our Bibles to Leviticus chapter 3. Leviticus chapter 3. If his offering is a sacrifice of peace offerings, then if he offers before Adonai an animal from the herd, then no matter whether it is male or female, it must be without defect. He is to lay his hand on the head of his offering and slaughter it at the entrance to the tent of meeting. And the sons of Aaron, the priests, are to splash the blood against all sides of the altar. He is to present the sacrifice of the peace offering as an offering made by fire to Adonai. It is to consist of the fat covering the inner organs, all the fat above the inner organs, the two kidneys, the fat on them near the flanks, and the covering over the liver, which he will remove with the kidneys. Aaron's sons will make it go up in smoke on the altar on top of the burnt offering, which is on the wood, on the fire. It is an offering made by fire, a fragrant aroma for Adonai. If his offering for a sacrifice of peace offerings to Adonai is from the flock, then when he offers it, no matter whether it's a male or a female, it must be without defect. If he brings a lamb for his offering, then he is to present it before Adonai. He is to lay his hand on the head of his offering and slaughter it at the entrance to the tent of meeting, and the sons of Aaron are to splash its blood against all sides of the altar. From the sacrifices made as peace offerings, he is to present Adonai with an offering made by fire. It is to consist of its fat, the entire fat tail, which he will remove close to the lower backbone, the fat covering the inner organs, all the fat above the inner organs, the two kidneys, the fat on them near the flanks, and the covering over the liver, which he will remove with the kidneys. The Kohen will make it go up in smoke on the altar. It is food, an offering made by fire to Adonai. If his offering is a goat, then he's to present it before Adonai. He is to lay his hand on its head and slaughter it in front of the tent of meeting, and the sons of Aaron are to splash its blood against all sides of the altar. He is to present from it his offering, an offering made by fire to Adonai. It is to consist of the fat covering of the inner organs, all the fat above the inner organs, the two kidneys, the fat on them near the flanks, the covering over the liver, which he will remove with the kidneys. The Kohen will make them go up in smoke on the altar. It is food, an offering made by fire to be a fragrant aroma. All the fat belongs to Adonai. It is to be a permanent regulation through all your generations, wherever you live, that you will eat neither fat nor blood. Well, here we encounter a third type of sacrifice, usually translated as the peace offering. And what we need to take notice of, that just like the first two kinds of sacrifices we looked at, the olah and the mincha, this one has nothing to do with atoning for sins. That is, this is another offering to God that does not deal with direct trespasses against Jehovah or the commission of bad behavior, sins. In Hebrew, this offering is called Zeva Shlamim, or more often it simply says in the Bible, Zeva. And not all scholars would translate those words to mean peace offerings. Some of your Bibles might say offering of well-being or offering of fellowship, or another more recent interpretation is the sacred gift of greeting. Why the problem translating this simple phrase, Zeva Shlamim? Well, the root of the word Shlamim, and remember now, Hebrew is a language that operates by establishing a root word, and then there's a lot of variances and nuances that are created from it. The root word is the same word from which we get a very familiar Hebrew greeting, Shalom. And almost most Gentiles don't realize it, but Shalom has a much broader and deeper meaning than hello or goodbye or how you doing. Shalom carries with it the idea of being a very gracious greeting, of wishing you to be at peace, of possessing well-being, of brotherly fellowship, all these things and more all at the same time. So none of these renderings of Zeva Shlamim that I'm putting forward are wrong. It's just that by themselves, they are fully, none of them are fully adequate to cover the name and the meaning of this sacrifice. So, this is a greeting, gift, fellowship, well-being, peace offering, sacrifice to Yahweh. And again, notice this is not about dealing with some sin that a worshiper has committed. For the sake of simplicity, I'm going to just go ahead and choose to call this particular sacrifice the peace offering. Now, this peace offering of Leviticus chapter 3 introduces a new class of offering, the Zeva. The Zeva is a lower class of offering than the Olah or the Mincha, and this is reflected in the fact that the Olah and Mincha are sacrifices where only the priests were permitted to use or benefit from any part of the sacrificial meat offering. Okay? In the Olah, the priest could keep the animal skin. In the Mincha, the priest could keep the bulk of the grain offering as their own food. In fact, they were required to eat that food within the courtyard of the tabernacle because it was considered a sacred meal. The Zeva, the peace offering class of sacrifice, was also considered a sacred meal. However, this sacred meal could be shared with the worshiper, a non-priest. So a layman could partake of it. There are several similarities between the Zeva, the peace offering, and the Olah, the burnt offering. Notice, for instance, that the practice of laying hands, semecha, as it's called in Hebrew, on the designated sacrificial animal is called for in both cases. Remember that semecha involves some sort of symbolic transference of guilt from the worshiper to the animal. The semecha also indicated that that particular animal was being designated by the worshiper as his sacrifice, and now it's being turned over to God as his property. Further, as with the Olah, the peace offering, the Zeva Shlamim, it involves only animals, never plant life. And these animals are to be burned up on the brazen altar. But there are differences between the Zeva and the Olah. Only certain parts of the animal are to be burned up with a peace offering. And the kinds of animals that can be sacrificed for a Zeva cannot include birds that could be sacrificed in the Olah. Further, as we're going to see later, the highest level of perfection of the sacrificial animal is not as stringent in most kinds of Zeva, but neither can it be a bad specimen. And of course, the key to the peace offering is that the worshiper, non-priests, laymen, may partake in the meat that's set aside that's not being burned up on the altar. Another key difference is that female animals may be used for the peace offering as well as male animals. Now for the Zeva, the peace offering, cattle, sheep, and goats can be used. And after being slaughtered, it's the fat from the animal that surrounds the liver and the kidneys and the entrails. That's what's burned up on the altar. This particular kind of sacrificial fat in Hebrew is called chelev. And this type of animal fat is not to be consumed by Israelites any more than the blood from the animals to be consumed. However, an animal's body contains another and different kind of fat. It's the layer of fat located just under the animal's skin or adheres to other places of the animal's flesh. This kind of fat cannot be used in sacrifices. So here in verse 5, we run to the problem that I spent the first few minutes of our lesson discussing, the one that kind of hurts our sensibilities. We're told that the peace offering is turned into smoke, which is a pleasant odor to Yehovah. I don't want to belabor the point, but again, notice the clear purpose of burning up the meat is to produce smoke, and the smoke carries with it an odor that's meant to go up to God. We're next told that if a sheep is offered as the peace offering, that in addition to the fat that surrounds those specified internal organs, the fat extracted from that sheep's tail is to be used. Now, this does not include the tail from every kind of a sheep. There was a special variety of sheep that was greatly favored by the Hebrews as well as other Middle Eastern cultures. It was called the fat-tailed sheep. It was the fat from the tail of that particular species that's being talked about here. In verse 12, a goat is named as an authorized peace offering. Now, this surprises some folks because they think that in the New Testament, when the returning Messiah speaks of separating the goats from the sheep, that somehow or another, goats have to be, in all circumstances, considered something that symbolizes uncleanness or evil. In fact, goats were prime sacrificial animals, and they were generally hardier and more prolific than sheep. They were perfectly acceptable sacrifices to Yehovah, yet they did hold a slightly lower status than sheep, and at times, like the separation of the goats from the sheep, they are considered lesser, and maybe at times somewhat negative, but not wicked, like leaven. Yeast and food, which could be both positive and negative depending on its use. Goats can also be seen to represent both sides of the coin in the Bible. Now, verse 17 gives us some important information. First, it tells us that this is a law regarding the chelev, the acceptable kind of sacrificial animal fat, and it concerns animal blood. Second, it gives us the statute of limitations of the effectiveness of this law. That is, how long is this law to be in effect? It states forever, for all time. And third, it explains where this law is in effect. The where is anywhere a Jew resides. It goes without further comment that this obviously includes the tabernacle. In other words, so far in Leviticus, the instructions have had nothing to do with what happens only in the tabernacle. Now the aspect of concerning the eating of fat and blood is extended to everywhere the Hebrews settle. Wherever they are, this law follows them. So what is the purpose of a peace offering? Beyond, of course, emitting that fragrant smoke. Leviticus 7, which we'll get into in a few weeks, gives us three reasons that the peace offering should be brought before the Lord. First, as a confession offering. Second, as a free will offering. Third, as a vow offering. And what we see is that the peace offering was a sacrificial offering that was to be used for special occasions. It was not a regular daily offering like the Olah and the Mincha. The Zevah was at the discretion of the worshiper. Well, we've already discussed that the Zevah is a gift of greeting to the Lord. It's a gift of peace. It's a plea for well-being. It's also a request for fellowship with the Father, which ties then in with the Olah and the Mincha. That is, all of these first three sacrifices we've studied are meant to maintain a peaceful relationship with God, to demonstrate our obedience, our loyalty to Him, and to gain personal acceptance by Him. It also demonstrates that the worshiper recognizes that it is this personal acceptance by God that gives the worshiper shalom, peace and well-being. Now let me put this in perspective, and it's a point that's awfully easy to lose track of. All of these sacrifices and all of these rituals and all of these laws are only meant for redeemed people. None of these sacrifices and rituals and following of the law brought redemption. Rather, it was that God first redeemed Israel. Later, He gave them the laws and the rituals that were needed for that redeemed people to repair and maintain their relationship with Him. It was no different for the people of ancient times when there was no more scripture than the Torah than it is for believers today who have a complete Bible. Just as Moses' flock didn't perform sacrifices in order to receive their redemption, it had been a free gift from God. So it is with us that God gives us redemption as a free gift through Messiah, and then later goes about explaining to us how to keep and maintain a right relationship with Him and what to do to restore it when we fail. I was at a church in Castleberry, Florida, some time back for a special function. And there was this dinner put on by the church that I was visiting where a young boy, about 10 years old, was called on to say grace for the whole group. His prayer was short and profound. And after thanking God for our meal, he said, "God, make me obedient so that I can live a good life. Make me obedient so that I can live a good life." That's probably the best summation for the meaning of the peace offering that anybody could ever give. Now let's take a look at each of the first three stated occasions for the giving of a peace offering, for the giving of a zavah sacrifice. And the first occasion is called the confession offering. It was used when the worshiper sought God for deliverance from his enemies, or perhaps healing from sickness. And since some unknown sin was often seen as the cause for oppression from an enemy for becoming ill, it was logical that confession of a sin was necessary. Now, it goes without saying that these sins would have been of the unintentional variety because they were unknown to the worshiper. But in reality, see, this was more about seeking God's mercy upon the sinful condition of the worshiper, not about an act of misbehavior. Acts of misbehavior were dealt with by means of other kinds of sacrifices we haven't even come to yet in our studies. I mean, to get an example of the practical use of the peace offering, the zavah, in an Israelite's life, pick up your Bibles and turn your pages to Judges chapter 20. Judges chapter 20. We're going to read verses 24 through 28. Judges chapter 20, page 295 if you have a complete Jewish Bible. Judges chapter 20, 24 through 28. So the army of Israel went out to attack the army of Benjamin the second day. But Benjamin went out against them from Geba the second day and slaughtered the army of Israel. 18,000 men armed with swords fell. Then the whole army of Israel, the people, went up to Beit El, and they cried out, and they sat there in the presence of Adonai. They fasted that day until evening and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings to Adonai and asked Adonai what to do. The ark for the covenant of God was there at that time, and Pinchas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, stood before it at that time, and they asked, "Should we still go out to battle again against our kinsmen, the people of Benjamin, or should we stop?" And Adonai answered, "Attack, because tomorrow I will hand them over to you." Now take a look in Judges 21. Just flip over a page. Judges 21, we're going to look at the first four verses. The men of Israel had sworn in Mizpah that none of them would let his daughter marry a man from Benjamin. Then the people came to Beit El and stayed there before God till evening, crying out and weeping. And they said, "Adonai, why has this come about in Israel? Why should there be today in Israel one tribe missing?" The next day the people got up early, built an altar, and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. In these two cases, the Israelites were perplexed by what was happening to them. So they first offered the olah, which was designed to gain God's attention and his favor, and next the peace offering as a confession offering, a confession of their sinful condition and of their unworthiness. Let's look now at a second and different type, or different use, shall we say, of the peace offering called the vow offering. It was typical in that day to make a vow to God that if he helped you out of some kind of a problem or would show you mercy for some kind of a special need, you'd pledge to do something for God in return. When that pledge, that vow to God, was fulfilled, then it would be capped off with a ceremony. And that included a peace offering, a zevah. The essence of this kind of zevah, this vow offering, is illustrated well in the story of Jacob fleeing his brother Esau after he had tricked him and obtained the firstborn birthright from their father, Isaac, that rightfully by tradition belonged to Esau. And we're going to look first at Genesis 28 and then Genesis 35, all right, to remind ourselves of this. See a use for it. Genesis 28. We're going to read verses 16 through 22. Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, "Truly God is in this place, and I didn't know it." Then he became afraid and he said, "This place is fearsome. This has to be the house of God. This is the gate of heaven." Jacob got up early in the morning, took the stone he'd put under his head, he set it up as a standing stone, he poured olive oil on top of it, and named the place Beit El, House of God. But the town had originally been called Luz. Jacob took this vow: "If God will be with me and will guard me on this road I am traveling, give me bread to eat and clothes to wear so that I return to my father's house in peace, then Adonai will be my God. And this stone which I have set up as a standing stone will be God's house. And of everything you give me, I will faithfully return a tenth to you." Now, in Genesis 35, Genesis 35. We're going to read verses 1 through 4 and then skip to 13 and 15. God said to Jacob, "Get up and go to Beit El and live there and make there an altar to God who appeared to you when you fled Esau your brother." Then Jacob said to his household and all the others with him, "Get rid of the foreign gods that you have with you and purify yourselves and put on fresh clothes. We're going to move on and we're going to go to Beit El. There I will build an altar to God who answered me when I was in such distress and stayed with me wherever I went." Then they gave Jacob all the foreign gods in their possession and all the earrings they were wearing, and Jacob buried them under the pistachio tree near Shechem. Now skipping to 13. Then God went up from him there where he had spoken with him. Jacob set up a standing stone in the place where he had spoken with him, a stone pillar, and then he poured out a drink offering on it, and he poured oil on it. Jacob called the place where God spoke with him Beit El. Now, if you recall from the beginning of our lesson today, I explained that God had long ago put his principles into practice, well before Moses, well before the law, but they had become degraded, corrupted to varying degrees. Here we have Jacob 500 years before Moses was given the law, performing a zeva type of offering. All the elements of the zeva are present. The standing stone that Jacob erected is in Hebrew matzebah, right, which can indicate a pillar, a marker, a very primitive kind of altar. Obviously, since Jacob is using it as a place of offering, here the matzebah is an altar. And the story shows that the vow made by Jacob, if you'll help me, you will be my God. And then many years later, when Jacob had fulfilled his vow by making Yehovah his God, he erects another matzebah. He sacrifices oil to God on it as a vow offering. The vow offering prescribed in such detail to Moses in Leviticus 3, 5 centuries after this incident with Jacob that we find in Genesis, has the same principles and essence. When Jacob set up the standing stone and made a vow and offered a sacrifice of oil, he wasn't ad-libbing. He didn't invent something new. What he did was customary. It was typical for his day, not just among Hebrews, but with all Middle Eastern peoples. The third kind of peace offering is called a free will offering. It was quite different from the vow and the confession kinds of peace offerings. Rather, this was simply a spontaneous expression of gratitude to Yehovah. It was done on very joyful occasions. All three types of peace offerings ended with a sacrificial meal, usually involving the worshiper and the priests. All three types of peace offerings were, in general, joyous in their nature, although the free will offering was the most joyous. Now, lest we think that the use by Hebrews of the typical, even pagan-like cultural religious expressions of that era even went so far as to imply that when the Israelites were enjoying their sacred meal in God's presence, that indeed God too was eating food, we only have to look at Psalm 50. Verses 12 and 13, it says this. This is God speaking. If I were hungry, I wouldn't tell you. For all the world and all that's in it, it's mine. Do I eat the flesh of bulls or drink the blood of goats? What we should take from this psalm is that the pagan mindset of Hebrews, even in the era of David, hundreds of years after Moses, at times must have actually viewed Yehovah as eating food, or God sure wouldn't have scolded the Hebrews about it. They still envisioned him in the cultural way that all Middle Easterners typically did of all their gods, as a kind of superhuman with all sorts of physical human-like qualities and needs. And God was making it quite clear, he does not have human like needs. And no, he doesn't eat and he doesn't drink. Therefore, the ultimate meaning of his instructions, such as here in Leviticus, whereby it speaks of the smoke being a lovely fragrance to God's nostrils, is not physical. It has a spiritual meaning. God doesn't have nostrils. He doesn't smell smoke the way we humans think of it. All of the scores, perhaps hundreds of times in the Bible, that we're told of God weeping or shouting or brandishing a sword or running after somebody, all these are figurative. Yet if Yehovah is going to communicate with mankind, with us, he's going to have to dumb it down. he's going to have to use terms that humans can identify with and understand. One final thing, and we'll call it a day. We'll not find the term peace offering or zeva in the New Testament, primarily because the only manuscripts we have are in Greek, not in Hebrew. Because zeva is a Hebrew concept, there's no equivalent Greek word. However, we have obvious references to various forms of the zeva sacrifices. Usually all the terms for the many different kinds of sacrifices we are in the midst of learning about are lumped into one all-encompassing word, sacrifice. But the various types of sacrifices are still identifiable in the New Testament due to the occasions and to the ways that they proceed. For instance, in Acts, when it says Paul paid for the offerings of four men who had taken the vow of a Nazarite, what he was paying for was the sacrificial animals necessary to perform the standard vow offering type of peace offering, or zeva. I guarantee you, if you'll stick with this, when you're done studying Leviticus, you're gonna, and you start reading the New Testament, you're gonna start finding yourself recognizing all kinds of various sacrificial offerings being performed, all kinds of biblical feasts going on that you never saw before. And all of a sudden, it's going to make a whole lot more sense to you.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seed of Abraham Fellowship.